Janet Yellen will at some point raise interest rates, and there will be much wailing and gnashing of teeth. But if you think people hate the Fed now, man, you should have seen it 100 years ago. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. We are in Chicago today at the studios of WBEZ. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The 20th of October is what my calendar says. Glad to have you along, everybody. Came in last night on a United flight. A flight, thankfully, without that gratuitous ad thing that former CEO Jeff Smizek used to do before the safety video. Smizek, as you may know, was relieved last month pending a corruption investigation. His successor, Oscar Munoz, has been getting positive reviews from analysts and United rank and file as well. Munoz, though, had a heart attack last Thursday. He's been in the hospital since. Last night, United named the company's general counsel the interim CEO, but there has been scarce little new information about Munoz and when or even whether he might come back to work. That line between the obligations of a publicly traded company and the privacy of the people who run that company is broad and blurry and very hard to navigate. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson starts our story with the most glaring recent example.
Thank you for coming this morning. We got some really exciting stuff to share with you.
In 2008, Steve Jobs walked on stage for an Apple event in that trademark black turtleneck. He was noticeably thin. Apple reps said he was suffering from a common bug.
Before we do, I just wanted to mention this.
The screen behind him read, "Reports of my death are greatly exaggerated."
Enough said. So let's get on with the real topic of this morning.
But was it enough?
Staying silent about the health situation of an executive is generally not a problem under the securities laws unless there's what we call an affirmative duty to speak.
Peter Barrick is a securities lawyer and partner at Barrick Verrazano.
It would have to be an expectation that the problem would have a material unfavorable impact on net sales or revenues or incomes.
Companies also have to disclose a change in leadership, like at United. After Steve Jobs and his illness, there was talk about whether companies should have to share more, but the law hasn't changed.
The other side is that there's also a question of privacy.
Thomas Liss is an accounting professor at Northwestern's Kellogg School of Management. He says CEOs, they're people. People who likely don't want to confront life or death issues in the public spotlight. Ironically, the more powerful a CEO, Liss says, the less likely a company will share information about their health. Although it is notable that both J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs promptly announced the cancer diagnoses of their CEOs. Tom Gorman, a partner at the law firm Dorsey & Whitney, says these disclosures are increasingly relevant in the age of the superstar CEO.
People might start to decide not to buy the stock, might decide to sell the stock, might change their views of how they want to invest. And that's the danger of having a superstar CEO, is that kind of thing can start changing valuation views on your company.
But Gorman says even without rules forcing more health disclosures, he thinks companies are increasingly volunteering it. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
All right, a very quick quiz now, the Marketplace quiz. The true global trade nerds among you will know the answer to this one. Our number one trading partner in terms of total trade. Anyone? Anyone? No, it's not China. It's not Mexico. It's not Japan. Our biggest single trading relationship is with Canada, a country that will very soon have very different political leadership. Justin Trudeau and his Liberal Party crushed Stephen Harper's Conservatives in elections yesterday. So Marketplace's Mark Garrison looks at what that shift in power might mean economically, both for them and for us.
Canada's big economic problem is that oil and other commodity prices are in the dirt. Trudeau says his administration's willing to go into debt to stimulate the economy.
Well, one thing that was really signaled in the campaign was a desire to invest a lot more in public infrastructure.
Glenn Hodgson is chief economist at the Conference Board of Canada, a nonprofit research firm.
Like the U.S., we've seen our public infrastructure kind of atrophy over maybe 25 years. It's everything from sewer systems to roads to bridges to ports.
Unlike the Obama administration, which has long called for far more infrastructure spending, Canada's new government can make it happen.
The Liberals want a really, really strong majority, surprisingly strong majority government, so they can pass through our parliament almost anything they want.
But they can't build the Keystone XL pipeline without U.S. support. It would carry Canadian crude through America. In general, politicians on America's left don't want it, while those on the right do. But it's more complicated in Canada. Both Trudeau and his conservative opponent backed the pipeline, as University of Victoria professor Lindsay Tedds explains.
The Liberals do support Keystone XL. The belief is that it will create jobs and growth.
It's a lost cause while President Obama is in office, but expect Trudeau to raise the issue again, especially if a Republican takes the White House. The more immediate issue facing the two countries is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal being finalized now. Jeremy Cronick is with the C.D. Howe Institute, a think tank in Toronto.
He's a pro-free trade party, so my guess is he will sign it. So I'm not sure there'll be a huge change on the trade perspective.
I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Wall Street Today. Yeah, lackluster is a word you might use. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Xi Jinping, the president of China, began a four-day state visit to the United Kingdom today. And truth be told, he is getting a way warmer reception from the Brits than he did last month in Washington. London is rolling out the red economic carpet in a very big way. But as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports, and as there so often is, there is more to this story. Here's Stephen.
A horse-drawn carriage ride up to Buckingham Palace, a state banquet, and an address to both houses of parliament. In terms of pomp, President Xi was getting what the Brits call the full Monty. But that didn't stop the opposition Labour Party from lashing out at him. Spokeswoman on business affairs Angela Eagle slammed the Chinese leader for the latest job losses in the British steel industry. 4,000 have gone in recent weeks, largely due to cheap Chinese imports.
What we're seeing here is the dumping of cheap Chinese steel, which is having an enormously bad effect on British industry.
And another Labour lawmaker, Fabian Hamilton, complained about China's human rights record, including what he calls the oppression of Tibet and the mistreatment of the Uyghur minority in China.
This is not a country that we should be allowing to get away with the kind of human rights abuse that our government seems so eager to ignore in the name of economic growth.
The British government is certainly eager to deepen commercial ties with China. More than $40 billion worth of deals are expected this week in nuclear power and financial services. But Foreign Secretary Philip Hammond insists the UK is not kowtowing to President Xi or ignoring Chinese abuses.
The more deeply embedded we are in each other's economies, the more closely we work together, the more opportunity there is to have a genuine discussion about these things.
But all today's pageantry could not conceal how unequal the relationship is and how powerless Britain is to change Chinese behaviour. British government criticism of China has become muted. A human rights activist in China said, "It's unfortunate they've rolled out a red carpet welcome for the president. That carpet," she said, "is stained with the blood of the Uyghur and the Tibetan people." In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
It was raining out in L.A. just as I was leaving last night, a precursor, fingers crossed, to what most people out in the West are hoping is going to be a big, fat soaker of an El Nino this winter. 4 years of drought, though, is a whole lot of water that we didn't get. And El Nino aside, with the odds on a hotter and drier future, a whole lot of attention is being paid to the agriculture-rich and water-use-intensive Central Valley of the state of California. Marketplace's Annie Baxter has that story.
Dennis Atkinson is surveying almond orchards owned by the company he works for, Tejon Ranch. Almond shells crunch underfoot. We're in California's Central Valley. The warm climate here makes it possible to grow food year-round. That and the rich soils are some of California's big advantages over other states when it comes to agriculture. They're the reasons why hundreds of different fruits, veggies, and tree nuts are grown here.
The ones that are ready to pick up, they snap like a potato chip.
Atkinson plucks an almond off a tree, shells it, and pops it in his mouth.
Very crunchy. And the one that's not ready yet, it's kind of crunchy, but it's more chewy.
Still, chewy is better than soggy. Atkinson says another one of California's virtues is that it doesn't rain much. Irrigation lets farmers apply just the amount of water they need to make their crops flourish. It might sound crazy, but Atkinson says rain actually messes things up.
In the middle of harvest, it can. In the almond business, it's a dry process all the way through. And the pistachios never touch the ground. They're caught in tarps and things. And so if you get a big rainstorm, the almonds are wet. Now you have to dry them. And the pistachios got knocked on the ground, and they're lost because you can't pick them up off the ground. There's too much chance of contamination. Well, think about your whole livelihood being lost on the ground.
Other parts of the country know this problem well. Harvests can be great one year and lousy the next, all because of too much or too little rain. Put all this together, and a lot of people, ag experts included, say there's really no place in the U.S. like California for growing food. That said, some changes are afoot. Mary Holtz Claus is dean of agriculture at Cal Poly Pomona.
We're now down 1.2 million fewer acres in production of California products, and primarily that's due to the drought.
Holtz Claus says California farmers are fallowing their water-guzzling, low-value crops like cotton and alfalfa, the latter being hay fed to livestock, and they're focusing more on fruits and nuts, some of which still use a lot of water but are way more valuable. Ag economist Bruce Babcock at Iowa State University says if there's demand for the crops California farmers are fallowing,
and no one else picks up the slack, the price of those crops will go up. That price increase will signal other regions or other countries to produce more of that crop.
Mexico being a prime candidate to pick up some of that slack. Babcock says those shifts aren't really happening yet, except in the case of dairy production, which is starting to move to other states. But overall, it doesn't seem like experts foresee a much bigger exodus of food production from California in the near term. Still, water expert Peter Glick at the Pacific Institute thinks there should be a bigger conversation about the best crops to grow in the state, because climate change might mean more droughts to come.
Climate change is real. It's already having an impact on California, especially California water, and on agriculture. And it's going to get worse. Temperatures are going to go up. There's going to be increasing pressure on water resources and increasing demand for water by the crops we choose to grow.
For now, he says, it makes sense to focus water resources on the high-value products like pistachios and almonds, but to use the most efficient irrigation techniques available. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Well, you got to hand it to the conspiracy theorists because, in fact, there was a conspiracy.
Whatever you do, don't tell Rand Paul the birth of the Federal Reserve straight ahead. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 13 points. That's less than a 10%. Closed at 17,217. The NASDAQ off 24 points, about a half percent. 48.80. The S&P 500 declined 2 points, a 10%. Ended at 20.30. Yum Brands, owner of KFC, Pizza Hut, and Taco Bell, announced today it's going to spin off its businesses in China. Fast food sales there have slowed. Wall Street toasted the news. Yum Brands cooked up nearly 2%. Harley Davidson, not so good. The stock reversed 14% after reporting weak sales. The company plans on eliminating some jobs this year. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury rose to 2.07%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. There's a new trend in retail to tell you about. Headsets, the virtual reality kind. Tommy Hilfiger said today it's going to start offering VR goggles in some stores so that customers can experience its fall runway show, whatever that means. Other businesses are experimenting with VR as well, the hope being that tech is going to help get shoppers in the door. But Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports that long-term V-commerce, as it's known, could also change retail as we know it.
These are early days for virtual reality and retailers. Businesses are trying to figure out how to make the tech work for them. Take Jeep. It worked with Morris May and his company Specular Theory to create a VR experience
where you literally become a surfer.
And what exactly does virtual surfing have to do with selling Jeeps?
To see it, you kind of sit inside the Jeep, so it draws a lot of attention to the product.
It's not all that different from Tommy Hilfiger's experiment, using virtual reality as consumer catnip. It's entertainment. But the potential for retail is much bigger. Adrian Slobin is vice president at the marketing agency Sapient Nitro. Imagine, he says, instead of shopping for a new dress at your favorite boutique,
you are shopping for a dress by walking through the designer's studio in Milan.
Using virtual reality, you can see the fabrics, the styles, maybe even peek at what's coming next season. And
when you land on a dress that you like, you can actually add it to cart.
That sounds like virtual reality could destroy the same brick-and-mortar stores who are using it as a lure today. Slobin doesn't think so.
The brick-and-mortar store is sort of like TV. Everyone is very willing to predict its demise, but somehow it lingers.
VR shopping, he thinks, will take off. But most of us also like moving through the world and the serendipitous encounters of real life. I'm Adrienne Hill for Marketplace.
One reality of having more women than ever serving in the military is that more women than ever are also eventually going back into civilian life. The brass at the Pentagon has noticed that women are having a tougher time than men are turning their military experience into private sector jobs, although they're not quite sure why that is. So Blake Farmer reports from WPLN in Nashville, female soldiers are learning how to dress for the jobs that they want.
Of the 40 female soldiers who signed up for this two-day class at Fort Campbell, some arrive in fatigues and combat boots, their hair in the regulation bun. Others ditch the camouflage, put on some earrings, and clip-clop their way inside a retreat center on post. Heels or flats, a skirt or slacks. Harold Riggins, a retired Army officer who helps soldiers find work, says while the military has become more and more gender-inclusive, women need specialized guidance on the way out.
I mean, we have one standard uniform. Everybody kind of dresses alike. And so as these young ladies are exiting the military, we want to give them every bit of knowledge that they need to succeed in the civilian workforce.
These women hold military jobs ranging from human resources management to air conditioner repair. Many of their skills translate easily outside the military, but the unemployment rate for post-9/11 veterans remains several percentage points higher for women than men.
I don't know what the reasons are, but with us not knowing, and there's a gazillion reasons, we just want to give them information.
This un-boot camp includes a full makeover. It's run by a new nonprofit called Operation Reinvent. Julie Lewitt Nuremberg is the founder.
It's very important for our ladies to reconnect with their feminine side. So, yes, the makeup might sound, you know, like, it's not. It's a very, very important growth opportunity.
Attendees also get to select an outfit from racks and racks of designer clothes donated for the events. Denise Brandt combs through blouses and stops on one a bit too revealing for her tastes.
It looks kind of hot, huh?
When Brandt retires next year, she'll have 20 years in the Army.
It's kind of awkward because I've been looking through my closet and I'm like, oh, I got church clothes, but I don't have dress clothes. I got uniforms. So I'm like in the middle of a mess right here.
Brandt welcomes the style help, but what does the fact that it's even being offered say about women and stereotypes, asks sociologist Meredith Claycamp. She studies the transition of soldiers into civilians at the University of Maryland.
Women who serve in the military may not be your typical girly girl. Many of them are, some of them aren't.
Claycamp says it shouldn't matter.
We need to have a society that says, hey, you like to, you know, not wear makeup and have short hair and you're direct and blunt. That's okay. That doesn't, you know, you don't have to act a different way or become a different person.
Intelligence analyst Kirsten McKinney says her 3 years in the Army have made her different from her high school friends, and not in bad ways. She says her former classmates seem more complacent than her sisters in arms. That is a point these workshops drive home. Don't forget everything you learned in the Army.
I think a lot of the women in the military have a lot stronger personalities. Like, a lot of the women that I work with are a lot more goal-oriented, a lot more go-getters.
McKinney's goal is to become fluent in Arabic and move to the Middle East. She hopes to work with nonprofits that empower women, though it's unlikely makeovers will be on the agenda. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
We spend a whole lot of time on this program talking about the Federal Reserve and what Janet Yellen and the gang may or may not do with interest rates. They get beat up quite a bit, the Fed does, by Congress and economists and analysts, especially in the past 7 or so years since Lehman Brothers. But the fact is, we haven't always had the Fed to kick around or, depending on how you look at it, to save our economic hides. The Fed's origin story is told in a new book by Roger Lowenstein. It's called America's Bank. Roger, it's good to have you back on.
Kai, it's always great to be on the show.
You know what hit me about this book? The fear and loathing that surrounds the Federal Reserve today was present at the very creation.
Yes, that sort of surprised me going into it, too. I mean, I knew going into the research that it was a struggle. But back then, the people who wanted to create the Federal Reserve couldn't even admit that that's what they were doing. They had all sort of disguised names for it. They went off on fake hunting trips to disguise their purpose. It was just, you know, anathema to the body politic then.
Well, so let's get to that secret meeting. The conspiracy theorists, once they pick up on this in this interview in this book, will go bananas that the Federal Reserve was started in a secret meeting on Jekyll Island, Georgia, in like 1913-ish.
Well, you got to hand it to the conspiracy theorists because, in fact, there was a conspiracy in the book.
Careful.
Well, I call it a patriotic conspiracy, but there was a senator from Rhode Island, a guy named Nelson Aldrich. Late in his career, he decided we needed a central bank. So he organized, and now I'm not making this up. This doesn't come from Warner Brothers Studio or anything. He organized a faux hunting trip to an island off the coast of Georgia where there was an exclusive resort where J.P. Morgan was a member. He made sure that there was nobody else in the hunting club. And this senator, three bankers, assistant treasurer, secretary of the treasury, who, by the way, didn't tell his boss, went down there for a week. They were plied with wild turkey, quail, stuffed oysters. They wrote what became the first draft of the Federal Reserve Act.
What was going on that these people decided they needed a central bank? It was uneasy monetary policy times.
Well, you know, listeners may think this is somewhat resonant with today, but there had been a financial panic and there had been a banking panic. So what happened in 1907 was every bank stopped lending. People ran to their banks, and in that day and age, I really mean ran to the banks. They, you know, crowded up on the sidewalks and everything. They tried to get their money out. And what do you know? The banks didn't have enough funds to loan them. So some of them shut down. Some of them began printing, in effect, you know, paper IOUs promising to circulate money when they had money. America had just a series of panics, money shortages, squeezes, and not infrequently full-fledged depressions. So that was why they thought that, as did every country in Europe, the U.S. needed a central bank.
Let's do a little counterfactual history. What happens if in 1913 Woodrow Wilson can't get this thing passed and we today don't have a Federal Reserve?
Well, I could say that we wouldn't have had the Federal Reserve to help us during the Depression, but the Federal Reserve wasn't much of a help during the Great Depression. So they kind of blew it. If you get to 2008, I think things would really get interesting because, you know, we had five, six banks failing. Those five, six banks, would have become 10, would have become 30, would have become, you know, thousands. It's very easy to see 2008 steamrolling into a Great Depression.
Take your historian's hat off for a minute and put on your sort of analyst of current thinking hat. Do you believe that the efforts to rein in the Federal Reserve, to increase auditing them, to limit their authority in times of crises, do you think that goes anywhere?
I don't, because you're going to have a divided White House and Congress now. When you say increase the supervision of the Fed by Congress, which is what these bills want, what you're really saying is have close political control of the Fed. People have always realized that you don't want, you know, people who have to run for re-election every 2 years making potentially unpopular monetary decisions. And by the way, I don't think those people in the Congress want that responsibility. Hmm. Do you think congressmen want to have to run for office saying, you can blame me for higher interest rates? So although they like to scream at the Fed, no, I don't think it's going anywhere.
It's a book called America's Bank, The Epic Struggle to Create the Federal Reserve by Roger Lowenstein. Roger, thanks a lot.
Kai, thank you.
This final note on the way out today, in the interests of equal time, I guess you might say. A couple of weeks ago, you could say that I gushed over the 2 days that I had driving a Tesla before an interview with Tesla CEO Elon Musk. They are quite spiffy cars, but not perhaps as spiffy as they thought, as we thought. Back in August, Consumer Reports gave the new Tesla Model S 103 points out of a possible 100. That is, it broke the scale. Yeah, except not so fast. Today, CR said that while the car is still great, it's got some reliability problems, which makes sense when you consider that it's basically just a big computer. The car, Consumer Reports said, quote, has an array of detailed and complicated maladies, end of quote. This is me, this little bit here. Still crazy fun to drive, though. My interview with Elon Musk is at marketplace.org. All righty, got to go. The Dow off 13 points today, less than a 10%. The NASDAQ down 24 points, about a 0.5%. The S&P 500 dropped 2 points, a 0.1%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. The senior digital producer is Nishad Kerwa. Thanks today to the staff here at WBEZ for getting us on the air. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back in L.A. tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.